Hello, this is Wendy Bauer with the Decatur Herald and Review, dated September 19th, 2016. We will begin today's reading on the front page with the article headlined, Pontiac Woody Station Wagon, a Rare Sight. This is by Tony Reed, the Herald and Review staff writer, from Decatur. Randy Goodrich is armed with a lot of ingrained skills when it comes to cleaning things. The owner of Randy's Expert Clean, a Decatur firm that can spruce up anything from your home's air ducts to its carpets and furniture, knows what cleaning and polishing products work best and where to use them. That's why he lavishes a lot of Lemon Pledge wood polish on his 1948 Pontiac Silver Streak station wagon Woody Hot Rod. After all, when three-quarters of the bodywork of your treasured chariot is crafted from mahogany and ash, you go with the flow. Goodrich explains that 68 years ago, Pontiac didn't actually make a station wagon. They built an already magnificent Silver Streak sedan and then shipped very few of them. The Woodies are as rare as hen's teeth. Off to the Ionia Manufacturing Company in Michigan, which did the station wagon bodywork in wood. Seriously, and we're not talking exotic lumber as applied luxury decoration. The sumptuously paneled wood on this vehicle forms much of the bodywork, doors, and all of the roof, which looks like an upturned boat view from the interior. The whole effect is pleasingly quaint and kind of historic, almost Elizabethan. If William Shakespeare had driven a car to and from the Globe Theater, it would have been a Silver Streak Woody. Goodrich says that all the fancy woodwork made the station wagon, priced at some $2,500, the most expensive in the Pontiac lineup for 1948. Resorts would buy them to haul guests around, he adds. But wooden cars didn't prove such a great choice for much of the New World climate. Not many Woodies were made to begin with, and by the time woodworm, dry rot, and the ravages of the weather were done, very few survived the slings and arrows of outrageous fortune. Goodrich, who loves cool cars and knows the rarity of this one, stumbled across his pride and joy at a local auction in 2002. Covered in grunge, a bit rotten, and stored in a barn since 1960, he had set a bid limit of $15,000 to buy it and ended up spending $19,500. Love knows no price restraint, and it soon turned out he wasn't barking up the wrong tree anyway. The very next weekend I could have made a $5,000 profit when somebody else wanted to buy it from me, he says. Over the intervening years, he sunk many more thousands of dollars and countless hours of sweat equity into his timber ride. Much of the wagon has been restored to just how it should look, but the car also features enhanced motivation thanks to a more potent engine transplant along with improved mechanics and essential luxuries such as added air conditioning. Goodrich and his partner, Tia Westbay, have seen the vehicle win a forest of awards at shows and say it's the ultimate head-turner. Most people are like, oh, wow, Westbay says. This car is just something you don't typically see going down the road. Some owners fortunate enough to possess such a cellulose gem would be tempted to mollycoddle it and only haul it around on trailers. That goes against the grain for Goodrich, who says the joy of owning a rolling piece of history is the sheer fun of driving it. With my Pontiac, if it's on a trailer, it's because it's broke, he says. And a few photographs accompany this article. The first, the photograph of Randy Goodrich and Thea Westbay, showing off their 1970 Chevrolet Chevelle and their 1948 Pontiac Woody wagon. And then a photo of Randy sitting behind the steering wheel. Randy Goodrich owns a 1948 Pontiac Woody wagon that is made out of approximately 50% wood. The final photograph showing his license plate that says Get Wood. The wood in Randy Goodrich's 1948 wagon is mahogany and ash. Also from the front page, Tony Reed writes, and this is from Moequa, two Central A&M students die in crash. The death of two students in a motorcycle accident Saturday night plunged the Central A&M school district into mourning. Senior Nathan M. Gully, 17, of Moequa, and junior Isaiah M. Tupince, 16, of Assumption, were pronounced dead in the HSHS St. John's Hospital Trauma Center. Sangamon County Coroner Cinda Edwards said the students were riding the motorcycle at the intersection of 9th Street and South Grand Avenue. News reports, quoting Springfield Police, say the motorcycle collided with a sport utility vehicle making a left turn onto 9th Street. News of the two deaths dealt the small, close-knit school an emotional hammer blow. Administrative staff opened up the high school building in Moequa on Sunday for students to come in and share their grief. An impromptu memorial was erected in front of the trophy case, where classmates posted poignant notes under pictures of the students. The personal lockers of Gully and Tupince were opened so more memorials, flowers, notes, and pictures could be left there. Central A&M Superintendent Deanne M. Heck said Sunday evening that students have organized a prayer at the pole meeting at 7:30 a.m. today, where they will gather at the school flagpole to pray for, remember, and mourn their friends. Heck said grief counselors will deploy to the school today and will be available throughout the week. The superintendent, whose educational career spans 25 years, said she has dealt with tragic situations in the past, but every case was different, difficult, and traumatizing for all involved. This has been very tough on kids in a small school, she added. Everybody knows everybody. We are family. We are family here. Social media filled rapidly Sunday with expressions of sympathy and grief over the students' loss. Central A&M High School Principal Charles Brown wrote on Facebook that the school administration had visited with both grieving families and had been told, "Both are so thankful for your thoughts and prayers. They also want us all to remember at this time to celebrate their young lives." Brown referred to the makeshift memorial at the high school and highlighted a sign made by some seniors that read simply, "Raider Strong," a reference to the school team name. A sign made by a few seniors today says it all, "Raider Strong. Together, as a family, we will make it," Brown said. And from the front page, an Associated Press article, "Look-alike guns pose agonizing decisions for law enforcement." Whether they shoot BBs, pellets, paintballs, or nothing at all, imitation guns can be indistinguishable from the real thing. It's one reason why some criminals gravitate toward them. Plus, they're cheap and easy to get. As Ohio authorities investigate the fatal police shooting of a 13-year-old boy, who officers said pulled a realistic-looking BB gun from his waistband, law enforcement agencies are grappling with the use of fake guns to commit very real crimes. "If I can't go get a real gun, it's easier for me to waltz into Walmart or whatever store sells these things and go get a replica. Because if I go to a store to hold it up, the guy behind the counter isn't going to know it's not real," said Jeffrey Alpert, a criminal justice professor at the University of South Carolina. While the federal government does not track criminals' use of toy or replica guns, some police departments say they've noticed an uptick. In Edmonton, Canada, police said imitation guns were involved in 1,598 incidents in 2015, up 38% from a year earlier. In Arlington, Texas, suspects are increasingly using look-alike guns, including an incident earlier this year in which a man carjacked a woman using an air gun that resembled a real pistol, and another case involving a teen who threatened an officer with a replica gun. The officer managed to knock it out of the teen's hands and tackle him. Arlington Police Lieutenant Christopher Cook said that between March and August, nearly 20% of the weapons seized by police after they were used in crimes turned out to be lookalikes. So far, police haven't had to use deadly force, but Cook said that could change in an instant. There's no training in the world that we know of where an officer can readily distinguish a real gun from a fake gun, he said. That's not realistic because officers have to make split-second decisions to ascertain whether it's a firearm or not. A look-alike weapon is at the center of last week's fatal police shooting of Tyre King in Columbus, Ohio. An officer responding to a report of a $10 armed robbery shot the teen after he pulled out a BB gun that looked practically identical to the weapon that police officers use, Columbus police said. A 19-year-old who said he was the boy's friend told a newspaper that Tyre had a real-looking BB gun, was out to rob someone, and ran from police. But an attorney for Tyre's family has called for an independent investigation, saying the family believes the boy's involvement in an armed robbery would be out of character, and the police version of events might not be true. However, the facts emerge in Columbus. The use of replica guns in crime has long vexed law enforcement. In the late 1980s, after a rash of high-profile police shootings of suspects carrying toy or look-alike guns, Congress authorized a study that found thousands of robberies and assaults to have been committed with imitation weapons between 1985 and 1989. The study also identified more than 250 cases in which an officer used force, deadly or otherwise, on a suspect brandishing an imitation gun. More recently, Associated Press research found at least 25 deaths involving look-alike guns mistaken by police for actual firearms across the country in the last two decades, dating to the 1994 slaying by a housing police officer of a 13-year-old in New York City. It's horrible. It's horrible when these kids are displaying these firearms and a life is lost, and after the fact, it turns out it's not real, said Allentown, Pennsylvania Police Captain Richard Landon. But he added it can be nearly impossible to tell an imitation gun from a firearm that shoots real bullets. It's human nature to defend yourself in the face of that, he said. At least 12 states, Washington, D.C., and Puerto Rico, have laws restricting the sale or use of firearm imitations, according to the National Conference of State Legislatures, while many cities and towns have ordinances on look-alike guns. Federal law requires imitation guns to have orange plugs in the barrel to distinguish them from real firearms, but the tips are easily removed, and experts question their effectiveness. And the photograph accompanying this article, Columbus, Ohio Police Chief Kim Jacobs on Thursday displays a photo of the type of BB gun police say Tyre King pulled from his waistband before he was shot and killed by a police officer investigating an armed robbery report. And the gun looks extremely real. And from the local page, from Decatur, by Ryan Voiles, staff writer for Herald and Review. More design work sought for downtown parking garage. Several months after it received exceedingly expensive bids, the city of Decatur will once again plan for ways to repair its aging downtown parking garages. The city is near an agreement with Carl Walker, Inc. to design improvements to the city-owned parking garages at the northwest corner of North Street and the northeast corner of Water and Franklin and Wood Streets, which have been staples of downtown for half a century. The $13,138 plan is expected to be voted on during tonight's City Council meeting. If approved, Walker Inc., a national engineering firm specializing in parking garage construction and restoration, would work with city staff to prioritize repairs, update project drawings and specifications, and assist with the project's bidding. The city has an existing $30,000 agreement with Walker, which did design work earlier this year before bids were opened for the project in June. But while internal cost estimates were roughly $1.8 million over a 7-year, 3-phase construction schedule, initial bids received exceeded the estimate by 79%. The bids were allowed to expire, and Assistant City Manager Billy Tyus said the approach to the work will be reexamined. The two parking garages were constructed in 1966 and have 1,454 spaces. One of the garages is leased to Archer Daniels Midland Company, which reserves a portion of the spots. A 2014 study revealed severe deterioration in several structural steel members in the garage at Franklin and Wood Streets. The deterioration required immediate shoring by the Public Works Department. The hope is to advertise for bids in January, with construction to begin by March. In other business, the council is set to vote on rezoning of the former site of the Big Creek Stables into a B2 commercial district. With the 13.7 acres at a high-traffic, signalized intersection off a state highway, officials deemed the best use of the site to be for commercial development. Although the Macon County and Decatur Comprehensive Plan shows the area as an open space, the potential for continuation as open space slash park was deemed low, as the park district no longer owns the property. There are no known groups looking to develop the plan, but Tyus said the zoning change should open up conversation. The council will also vote to change 2 chapters of its code on marijuana to align better with recent changes made by the state. If approved, the new language would define a city civil offense to be possession of 30 grams or less. In addition, a vehicle may be impounded when it is being used while in possession of 10 grams or more of marijuana, or it is being used in the delivery of a controlled substance. The state recently amended the Cannabis Control Act and the Drug Paraphernalia Control Act to reduce possession of cannabis 10 grams or less to a civil violation. Possession of more than 10 grams to 30 grams, a Class B misdemeanor, and possession of drug paraphernalia while in possession of 10 grams or less of cannabis, a civil violation. And the sidebar states that if you go, the Decatur City Council meets at 5:30 p.m. today in the Council Chambers, 3rd floor, Decatur Civic Center, 1 Gary K. Anderson Plaza. Also on the local page, Tony Reed writes, "Monarch Madness aims to aid butterflies' plight." This from Decatur. 6-year-old Katie Ellison got up close and personal Sunday with a winged summer visitor who might not be there when she grows up. "I like butterflies," said Katie, after she felt the brush of a monarch butterfly's delicate wings at Rock Springs Nature Center in Decatur. "I like how they look pretty," added Katie, who lives in Morton. She was in town to visit her grandmother, Margie Cook, one of Macon County University of Illinois Extension Master Gardeners, running what they call Monarch Madness. It was an afternoon devoted to introducing the public to the glories of the monarchs, which flutter through our gardens, and summer memories like slivers of orange-stained glass. But not as many are fluttering by these days than in previous years, with loss of habitat and use of pesticides wiping out 90% of the population in just 2 decades. Monarch Madness, now in its 2nd year, is trying to save them. There were information videos outside the Nature Center, along with lemonade and cookies, and captive monarchs outside awaited release after they had been tagged, a process dozens of young visitors, such as Katie, got to participate in. The tags help scientists track the movement and health of monarch populations, which fly hundreds of miles to spend the winter in Mexico. Their caterpillars only eat milkweed, which is fast disappearing, and the gardeners had milkweed plants on hand for visitors to take home and grow. "We'd very much like people to do that," said Master Gardener Jan Sickbert, a member of the organizing committee for Monarch Madness. "If we lose the monarch, we lose a great pollinator, just like bees, and that's not good. And, well, the monarchs are just so wonderful to see." Her daughter, Cindy Blobaum, is a naturalist working in Iowa who journeyed to Decatur to demonstrate the tagging process. She also taught how to catch butterflies with nets, and hunting parties trooped off into the woods searching for wild examples to tag. The little stick-on tags feature a website address, contact phone number, and an identification number. Finders of deceased monarchs call the information in. There's even a $5 reward to encourage Mexican finders, and the scientists studying monarchs learn more about them. "When they first started tagging, they didn't know monarchs migrated or where they went," said Blobaum. "This is how they found out." And the photographs accompanying this article, the first shows a little boy with a wonderful monarch painting on his face. 6-year-old Jonah Wood gets to hold and help tag a monarch butterfly during the Monarch Madness event at Rock Springs Nature Center. And a little girl looking at a demonstration and a display of a number of monarchs. A tagged monarch, all ready for release. Katie Ellison 6 checks out the tiny details on the tag, which finders can register online or call in. The tags help scientists track and monitor the health of monarch butterfly population. Then Valerie Wells, staff writer for the Herald and Review, writes from Decatur, "Art meets technology meets success for Siblings Scholarships." Siblings, Samuel and Erica Flickinger, both have a $1,000 boost to their college funds thanks to their hard work and an artistic competition with a technological twist. Sam, 16 and a senior in high school, and Erica, 12, a seventh grader, were attending Dream It, Do It camp in June. Both are homeschooled. "They said they were looking for people to submit pieces of art," Sam said. "We ended up winning and were able to go to Chicago for the day, and it was a great time." The competition, sponsored by the Manufacturing Institute, required the original art to depict the students' vision of the future of manufacturing. Erica, who has competed in FIRST Lego League Robotics, drew her inspiration from last year's theme of recycling. "Using Arduino, a software that allows users to create interactive electronic objects, she placed a gear in the middle of her piece which moved trash from one side of the picture to being repurposed into something new at the other end. I thought that maybe, instead of looking at a landfill and seeing trash, people could look at a landfill and see the possibilities in things being reused and recycled and better than it was originally," Erica said. Sam's entry, using the same software, was a robot with sonar eyes and LED antennas that sensed the approach of a person, which made the antennas light up. "The camps are held in Illinois and Connecticut," said Nina Marie Costa, a spokeswoman for Sandvik Coromant. The company is a supplier of tools in the metalworking industry and sponsored the competition. The judging was based on the best artistic vision and incorporation of the theme of the International Manufacturing Technology Show, which was, "Together We Shape the Future of Manufacturing." Sandvik Coromant donated $50,000 to support the Dream It, Do It camps, which give students opportunities in the fields of science, technology, engineering, and mathematics. Sam is planning a career in engineering or computer science and is deciding among the University of Illinois, Rose Hulman Institute of Technology, Carnegie Mellon University, and Georgia Institute of Technology. Erica has a while to think about it, but she's leaning toward technology or engineering. In the sidebar notes that on the web, information about the competition and a video, including Sam and Erica, is at http://prn.to/2CGDA V. And from the A3 briefs on the local page, from Decatur, robbery report doubted. A Decatur man claims he was robbed at gunpoint early Saturday, but police have their doubts. The 24-year-old told officers he had been sitting in his vehicle at 1500 East Johns Avenue and 16th Street at 1:30 a.m. when he was accosted by several people who threatened him with a weapon before taking cash. But written reports describe the man as heavily intoxicated, telling a story that shifted, and said he was unable to provide any of the description of the robbers. From Decatur, another A3 brief, expect safety checks. Police are warning Decatur motorists they will face stepped-up roadside safety checks throughout the rest of the year. Heightened patrols will target drivers under the influence of alcohol and drugs, transporting open liquor, driving without a license, safety belt infractions, or operating vehicles with defective equipment. The increased enforcement activities are made possible through federal highway funds administered by the Illinois Department of Transportation. And finally, the A3 briefs list from Mount Zion, fall rec classes. Registration is open for Mount Zion Recreation Department fall classes. For more information, call 217-864-5424. Or visit www.mountzion.com. And from the mailbag on the opinion page, events show that Decatur's a great place. Just a quick thank you for Decatur and all the people who make things happen in our community. There was a flurry of activity around the last few days. Here is a short list, just to name a few. Wonderful Labor Day parade, our local police and firemen putting their lives on the line every day to keep everyone safe, incredible restaurants, loving churches, temples, synagogues, the iconic Dell's Popcorn Shop reopening, city government setting up a much-needed junk dump day in the Civic Center parking lot, Kirkland concert with Perkins, Lewis, Cash, and Presley, the 9/11 memorial tributes and car show in Central Park, Chris Herron's riveting personal story with drug addiction, not to mention the annual upcoming food drive. Wow! Thanks again, Decatur. Please don't forget to pray for and vote in our upcoming presidential November election. Proud to stand for our national anthem, written by Terry A. Mason of Decatur. We'll take a short break now and return with the second half hour of the Decatur Herald and Review, September 19th, 2016. Please stay tuned.